the climate crisis is something that's so important to not only us, but so many people here.
Climate protesters in Washington, D.C. continue to pressure President Joe Biden after he approved the Willow Project. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new report found that homicides increased steadily and significantly in Alaska over the last decade.
This homicide report is just the beginning of some very good data.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Climate activists aren't letting up after President Joe Biden last week approved ConocoPhillips' Willow Project to drill for oil in Alaska's western Arctic. They've launched a series of protests in Washington, D.C. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin went to one protest today and reports the issue could dog Biden into next year's presidential campaign.
Inside the Interior Department headquarters near the White House, Biden announced new monuments in Nevada and Texas, as well as a new marine sanctuary southwest of Hawaii. He also used the occasion to brag on his environmental and climate record.
You know, my first year in office, we protected more lands and waters than any American president since John Kennedy. And
meanwhile, outside the Interior Department, about 20 anti-Willow protesters beat on plastic drums. Organizers played recordings of Biden on a loop, mocking the campaign promises they say he broke, especially when he approved Willow.
No more subsidies for fossil fuel industry. No more drilling on federal lands. No more drilling.
Biden made action to reel in greenhouse gas emissions a central plank in his campaign. His decision on Willow, the largest pending oil project on federal land, quickly galvanized opposition online, particularly among young people who watched anti-Willow TikTok videos by the millions. So far, the in-person protests haven't been of that scale, but the sustained focus could threaten to tarnish Biden's legacy on climate. Nadia Nazer is an organizer with a youth-led climate justice group called Zero Hour.
We're trying to tell Biden that he can still change. You know, he can still change the decision, reverse the act. We're just trying to reach him directly. We're hoping he's in this building.
Nazir, an art student from Baltimore, says the protesters want Biden to feel the pressure when he makes future decisions on oil development and to know that his re-election could be on the line.
A lot of young people turned out and voted for him last election, and he made these promises to us, and the climate crisis is something that's so important to not only us, but so many people here.
Protesters also disrupted a presentation at a Washington think tank this week featuring White House climate advisor Ali Zaidi. A group called Climate Defiance says it intends to blockade the White House Correspondents' Dinner next month. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A resolution to protect the Southeast Alaska troll fishery passed in the state legislature yesterday on a unanimous vote. House Joint Resolution 5 calls on state and federal governments to defend Alaska fisheries from a lawsuit filed by the Washington state-based environmental group, the Wild Fish Conservancy. The suit seeks to stop the Southeast troll fishery over what the Conservancy sees as a threat to the southern resident killer whales in Puget Sound. The organization's position is that terminating Southeast king salmon troll fishery might allow Chinook salmon to migrate back down the coast through key hunting grounds of the southern resident killer whales. The southern resident exclusively eat salmon. They are also genetically, behaviorally, and even culturally distinct from other groups of killer whales. But according to NOAA Fisheries, the population has been in decline for decades. They now number in the 70s. Many local governments in Southeast Alaska have passed resolutions opposing the lawsuit, including Petersburg, Wrangell, Ketchikan, Sitka, and Juneau. Kodiak State legislators are concerned about Alaska's shrinking budget. KMXT's Brian Venwa reports that was a main takeaway from their Calm Fish presentation last week.
There wasn't much talk about fish at the state legislative update on Friday, but Representative Stutes did provide one big update for fisheries. The Commissioner of Fish and Game is creating a new board to tackle bycatch.
People were frustrated, didn't know who to call, what to do, when they thought there were bycatch issues, and now there's going to be an actual board that falls under the state boards and commissions.
Stutes also reiterated struggles with finding a crew for Alaska Marine Highway System ferries, including the Kennecott. The current plan for the Kennecott is to launch as soon as they're able to find and train staff. It will remain tied up at the dock in the meantime. Funding for the Marine Highway System has been a challenge overall, and Stutes says it's difficult to work with an inconsistent and shrinking budget.
When this budget was created that we're on now, it was created on $102 barrel oil. And as you know, we're down to $73 a barrel. So we already started out in the hole.
Senate President Gary Stevens was unable to be at Comfish in person, however was able to attend virtually. He says the only way for the state to have any kind of budget is to take from the permanent fund dividends earnings.
We have to use the earnings of the permanent fund both for funding our government and avoid charging you taxes to do that, and we have to use that to provide the permanent fund dividends. So we'll try to keep that dividend as high as we can. It was very high this year. I don't think it'll be that high this coming year.
Dunleavy's current budget suggests using about half of this year's earnings to run the government, but Stevens says the legislature could use up to 75% of the PFD's earnings to run the government's programs. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Venois.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, biologists say humpback whale populations in Southeast Alaska are improving.
The good news is that whales are very resilient. They are really capable of rebounding.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Parents go to great lengths to protect their little ones. When it comes to protection from childhood diseases, go with the safest, most effective choice. Start strong by getting all recommended vaccines for your baby by age 2. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. That's vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Yearly homicides more than doubled from 2011 to 2019 in Alaska. That's according to the state's report on the most recent homicide data, which shows the annual homicide rate increased steadily and significantly over the last decade. Alaska's homicide rate is higher than the national average. The state epidemiologist Deborah Hall-Gilley says the state makes these reports so epidemiologists and other state agencies can see how Alaska's homicide rate is changing over time.
What we saw when we looked at the timeline is that we see about midpoint this increase. So what's the difference? What's happening there that is impacting homicides and having more homicide victims in over the last 5 years?
Here's what's new. 532 Alaskans were killed from 2011 to 2020, most with guns and most in the last 5 years of the study. Homicides by firearm increased substantially in most regions in Alaska. Men were the most frequent victims, accounting for 2/3 of the homicides in the state. Of female victims, nearly 40% were killed by intimate partners like current or former spouses. Alaska Native people were killed at 4 times the rate of white Alaskans. Nearly half of the state's homicides took place in Anchorage, which is home to almost 40% of the state's population. But Hall-Gilley says there was another metric that mirrored the bump in the rise in homicide rates in the last 5 years. More than half of the homicide victims tested positive for the use of alcohol or drugs, especially marijuana and methamphetamines.
This homicide report is just the beginning of some very good data, working with our law enforcement partners to see if we can't identify more information that will aid in the prevention of these cases.
Homicides counted in the study are only for closed cases. The first year of the pandemic was an exception to the other years of the study. While homicides spiked in the rest of the nation, they decreased by more than a third in Alaska. With a statewide backlog in providing SNAP benefits, the state recently reallocated more than $1.5 million from emergency funds to help alleviate hunger around Alaska. Dedicated volunteers and advocates in Homer are working to promote food access in the community through the local food pantry and statewide food security initiatives. KBBI's Sean McDermott reports.
Afternoon light streams through the windows of the Homer United Methodist Church as a swirl of volunteers pack up food, plastic crates, and folding tables.
Like we set up a whole store and deli every Monday and then break it down.
That's Laura McBride, the coordinator of the Homer Community Food Pantry. She says the $1.7 million in state funding for food assistance will provide some relief for communities around Alaska.
Food Bank of Alaska can send 1,000 pounds of dry, shelf-stable goods to any agency that applies for temporary partnership with Food Bank of Alaska.
As the food pantry faces a recent rise in local food costs, she says the new funding is a huge help.
It's only just this recent program that has come through that will so much help us with the price of canned food. The food bank could give us way better prices from these distributors in the lower 48.
Betty Seaman, a weekly volunteer who is on the board of the food pantry, says she's already noticing the impact of the funding, as the Kenai Peninsula Food Bank in Soldotna recently sent a truck down to Homer with additional food.
We got a lot of food from them, and we haven't gotten food from them in quite some time.
Nevertheless, this is a hard time of year, Seaman says. The food pantry's budget has tightened with higher food prices, and there's less fresh produce available through the winter, whereas in the summer, farms regularly donate locally grown vegetables.
We've had less food because we had to cut back on what we were buying. We've been getting less food from the food bank because they've had less food. It's just kind of tough all the way around.
Here in Homer, the food pantry regularly distributes around 150 boxes of food to families and individuals each week. Seaman adds they really need fresh produce and more proteins, like frozen game and fish. It's those kind of local food connections that Robbie Mixon, the Homer-based director of the Alaska Food Policy Council, is trying to build. The Alaska Farmers Market Association, where Mixon also serves as executive director, recently secured a $500,000 grant to match food benefits like SNAP and WIC, helping recipients to shop at local farmers markets around the state.
So that's great for them and great for our farmers.
In February, Mixon was part of a coalition that flew to Juneau for an annual food security week, where people working with food banks, farmers markets, and farmers themselves met with legislators to discuss food access in Alaska.
Addressing hunger issues and building a more secure system seems to be very bipartisan. Seems like there's support from all sides of the aisle, which is pretty wonderful.
Yet the $1.7 million for immediate food aid is a temporary stopgap for a much larger issue. Kate Burkhart is the Alaska State Ombudsman. Her office independently assesses complaints against state agencies and fielded a flood of claims about delays in SNAP food assistance benefits starting last summer.
If you live in a community without that resource, we struggle with where to refer them for food security. I think it has really highlighted that the safety net for folks who are food insecure is being pulled very thin right now.
In Homer, I'm Sean McDermott.
Earlier this month, Governor Mike Dunleavy introduced legislation that would require parental permission for Alaska students to participate in school clubs related to gender and sexuality. In Juneau, two such clubs are open to middle schoolers. They're both called the Alliance, like other gender and sexuality alliance clubs across the country. At one club meeting last week, students told KTOO's Yvonne Crumery what the group means to them.
About 20 kids gather in a classroom with pride flags draping the walls. They're eating snacks, showing each other videos, and talking about their days at school. Typical middle school stuff. A few came out into the hall to talk about the club.
What does GSA mean to you?
A place you can be yourself.
That's a student who asked not to be identified for this story. KTOO agreed in order to protect their privacy.
So my mom is, like, not against LGBTQ and stuff like that. So, like, and I can't really be, like, myself around her because, like, she doesn't like that stuff. So, like, I've been coming here for, like, around, like, 4 months And I think, like, I really like this place.
Oliver Schufelt is an adult facilitator with the Alliance. They say clubs like the Alliance are necessary because kids may not have other LGBTQ plus family members or support.
That sort of community isn't really baked in for these kids, that we really have to intentionally create that. And these kids often have to seek it out. But these are really life-altering, life-saving spaces.
And when they say life-saving, it's not an exaggeration. The Trevor Project reported last year that 45% of LGBTQ youth in Alaska seriously considered suicide in the past year. And 64% of LGBTQ youth in Alaska lacked access to medical health care they wanted. One of the top reasons was that they didn't want to ask their parents for permission. Another student in the Alliance said they're out to their mom, but not their dad. And if they had to get permission from him, they may not be able to come anymore.
With my mom, it wouldn't be a problem. Like, she knows about me being transgender, but my father doesn't. And that would cause problems.
For now, they tell their dad they go to a homework club after school. Some of the youth said their parents were supportive of their identities and know they go to the Alliance group. But the group is still special because they can be around other youth who share their identities. For others, the group offers support while they think about how to talk to their families about who they are. The Alliance meets weekly at Floyd Dryden and Zondagahini Middle Schools. The Zach Gordon Youth Center has a weekly group for LGBTQ plus teens each Thursday. The groups are open to any student on a drop-in basis. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
A state lawmaker sent a letter to Alaska's Board of Education yesterday opposing a resolution the board passed last week in favor of banning transgender girls from competing on girls' sports teams. Anchorage Senator Lukey Tobin, a Democrat, chairs the Senate Education Committee. In the letter, she says the policy targets a small number of vulnerable students.
I find this divisive. I find this abhorrent. And I find this utterly disappointing that we are watching the lower 48 culture wars come to Alaska.
The resolution asks the Department of Education and Early Development to divide sports teams into two categories. Instead of boys and girls, there would be one for students assigned female at birth and one open to students of all gender identities. Board member Lori Van Diest introduced the resolution during last week's meeting. She told the board it would ensure fairness and safety for cisgender girls.
It really is impossible to balance the values of competitive fairness, inclusion, and safety because they conflict. Therefore, one has to prioritize them.
The board voted to pass the resolution and send a copy to school districts, legislators, and the Alaska School Activities Association. Billy Strickland is the association's executive director. Their current bylaws leave the decision to allow transgender girls to play on girls' teams up to school districts. The Department of Education has no immediate plans to change their policy. Strickland says if they do, the association would follow suit.
Our basic intent right now is to work with Department of Ed and see what they're basically planning to do, and then just be ready to for sure be able to change it if need be.
In his 9 years on the job, he says, only one transgender student athlete has competed in a state championship. The resolution passed a week after Governor Mike Dunleavy introduced a bill requiring parent permission before students could change their names or pronouns at school and separating bathroom facilities by gender assigned at birth. the Pacific Marine heat wave, nicknamed the Blob, devastated Alaska's marine ecosystem between 2014 and 2016. It turned sea stars into goo and caused dead seabirds to wash up on beaches. Researchers believe it led to the death of almost half of the resident humpback whales in Glacier Bay and the Icy Strait region of southeast Alaska. It was one of the longest marine heat waves to ever hit the Gulf of Alaska. But wildlife biologist Janet Nielsen with Glacier Bay National Park says things are looking up for southeast's humpback whales as temperatures return to normal.
The good news is that whales are very resilient. They are really capable of rebounding.
Southeast Alaska is an important feeding ground for humpbacks. They fuel up here before returning to winter breeding grounds in Hawaii and Mexico. But the heat wave caused an underwater famine, which may have killed almost half the regular whales in Glacier Bay and Icy Strait. Fortunately, the 2022 humpback whale monitoring update released last week by the park shows signs of improvement.
We're seeing whales looking like they're in better body condition. We're seeing less emaciated whales, less skinny whales.
Whales are staying in Glacier Bay and Icy Strait for longer, too, which probably means more plentiful food. Still, birth rates have not returned to normal. Scientists are not sure exactly why, but Nielsen says that may mean female whales have not recovered enough nutrition.
A lot of females that we would expect to have calves, they're just not coming back with calves. We're not sure what's the problem there. It could be that they're just not in good enough body condition to support a pregnancy.
And for adult whales, the threat of vessel strikes still looms. 2022 survey documented at least one death of an adult female whale near Angoon from a ship strike. The report cites the increasing number of whale-watching boats in southeast as a concern also. Too much boat activity can stress humpbacks, which makes proper feeding even more difficult. Southeast Alaska's sea otters were driven to near extinction by the fur trade in the early 20th century. But since they were reintroduced to the region in the 1960s, their numbers have grown considerably. Sea otters are a keystone species, protecting vital kelp beds, but they also prey on crab and clams that make up lucrative fisheries. They're protected by federal law, and only certain Alaska Native people can hunt them. But as otter populations have grown, so have calls to loosen the strict federal rules protecting them. And as KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, that has some people concerned.
Christy Ruby stands in her studio on the north end of Ketchikan, next to a table piled high with soft blue, red, and purple sea otter pelts. These are her best-selling colored sea otter, and since 2017, she's used the dyed fur in her traditional handicrafts.
I use them sparingly because it costs twice or three times as much to have them dyed that color.
She says the rich colors are what make her creations unique. She's grateful for her ability to hunt the animals. But Ruby worries that efforts to reform sea otter management could jeopardize her business and traditional creations. To be clear, scientists aren't sure that otters are overpopulated in southeast Alaska. There are now more than 25,000 spread throughout the panhandle, and one 2019 study estimated that the region's ecosystems could support three times as many. But that hasn't stopped efforts to reduce their numbers. Ketchikan's Borough Assembly recently took the topic to lawmakers in Washington, D.C., and asked for control of the federally managed species to be turned over to the state, or for current regulations to change. It's not the first time the issue has come up. Petersburg's Assembly called for higher harvests in 2018. The late Congressman Don Young attempted to make it easier to sell intact hides. Proponents say that increasing sea otter hunting would help bolster lucrative shellfish fisheries. But Ruby says those changes won't fix the problem, at least not without putting her traditional work at risk. She says state control of otter hunting could result in more red tape, preventing her from creating her work.
The state will get funding, and they'll have areas where they'll close off to even natives won't be able to hunt that area because they say there's lack of otters there, which, you know, you cannot track an otter. They move all the time.
She's worried about allowing non-native hunters to kill sea otters. That's against the law under the 1972 Marine Mammal Protection Act. If the rules are relaxed, Ruby says she thinks hunters will flood the market with hides and lower the value of their traditional work she creates.
They'll turn them into coats and all this stuff that they want to do, and our crafts will be gone because we don't have the ability to pay that much money for what the hunters will get for that hide.
She's also worried about backlash. If sea otter pelts become a widely traded commercial commodity, she says she's concerned that could spark calls for hunting to be banned outright. Will Ware, a Tlingit artist who lives in Petersburg, also opposes opening sea otter hunts to non-native people. He says there are simpler solutions, starting with the Marine Mammal Protection Act itself. The law currently requires hunters to be at least 1/4 coastal Alaska Native by blood quantum. He says he'd like to allow any enrolled tribal member to hunt.
I think you would see a lot more otters being harvested each year. That would be low-hanging fruit that would immediately make a difference.
Weir also thinks that the rule should change to allow the exportation of tanned hides and handicrafts to Canada. Neither is currently allowed under federal law. He says Tlingit and Haida people have been sending goods through that route for years. Jeremiah James, an artist based in Yakutat, also has an issue with marketing laws. Some of his pieces have sold for around $1,000, but he can't reach a wider market.
It's one thing to sell it in the country to each other, but we're just passing money back and forth, and that's not how you create wealth.
He also agrees that non-native people shouldn't be allowed to kill sea otters. He says laxer rules could allow businesses to squeeze out Alaska Native artists.
When people talk about opening it up to more people, all I see is another thing that's been taken away from my people.
But Ware, the Petersburg artist, says he sympathizes with crabbers and dive fishermen who say that higher otter populations are weighing on fisheries. He emphasized that he doesn't want to pit fishermen and native hunters and artists against each other.
We sense the frustration. Alaska Natives utilize the shrimp and crab, you know, as a part of our subsistence foods and our traditional and customary foods for millennia. We don't want to see the crab or shrimp disappearing any more than anyone else.
Back in her brightly lit studio, surrounded by fur-draped mannequins and old sewing machines, Ruby, the Ketchikan artist, says she agrees. She thinks the answer lies in more aggressive support for native hunters, and maybe even more communication with crabbers and fishermen about where they're seeing the otters move.
It's a no-brainer when it comes to actually making something happen, but we just don't get the full cooperation from everybody.
The bottom line, she says, is that policymakers concerned about the impacts of otter populations should focus their efforts on increasing the capacity of existing hunters and craftspeople. She says a Southeast Alaska tannery, for instance, would allow her to process more hides and cut down on considerable shipping costs.
Because there's no tannery quality tannery here. We have a few tanneries, but they don't put out the quality that people really want to use.
She says hunters, crabbers, and dive fishermen all have the same goal, and they should work together. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Shelby Herbert in Petersburg, Brian Benoit in Kodiak, Claire Strumpel, Anna Canny, Yvonne Crumry, and Katie Anastas in Juneau, Sean McDermott in Homer, and Reagan Miller in Ketchikan. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us, news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Dave Emmert. Tim Rocky is our producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks with 400 guest rooms and 1,700 square feet of meeting space. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
And by
Matson, delivering the goods and materials Alaskans depend on. On Facebook at Matson in Alaska. Matson, supporting public media in Alaska.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.